Today is Thursday, February 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The World Health Organization investigation team visits a virology center in Wuhan, China.
The WHO's fieldwork will last 2 weeks and has already taken them to hospitals and several markets in the central Chinese city.
Plus, as the pandemic continues, is it helpful to wear more than one mask? And expanding the definition of family in South Korea.
Grace Chung, a professor at Seoul National University's Department of Family Studies, says in the government's eyes, same-sex families don't exist.
We'll have these stories and more next. A team of investigators working on behalf of the World Health Organization visited a major virus research laboratory in Wuhan, China, Wednesday. The team is looking into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson is up first.
It's day six of their fact-finding mission into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Driving through thick morning mist, the team were bombarded by journalists' questions. Scientist Peter Daszak is the president of the EcoHealth Alliance.
We're looking forward to meeting with all the key people here and asking all the important questions that need to be asked.
The Wuhan Institute of Virology has been the subject of several conspiracy theories.
Did you find anything inside?
Some claim that a leak from the lab caused Wuhan's first coronavirus outbreak at the end of 2019. But most scientists reject that hypothesis. There have, however, been calls for the lab to release details of all coronavirus samples studied there. The WHO's fieldwork will last 2 weeks and has already taken them to hospitals and several markets in the central Chinese city. The trip has been plagued by delays, concern over access, and bickering between Beijing and Washington. Beijing has also repeatedly sought to cast doubt on the notion that the pandemic originated in China.
U.S. health authorities continue urging Americans to wear masks, but how many? AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that part of the story.
Dr. Anthony Fauci says he gets asked a lot.
Should you be wearing two masks or one mask?
It's up to you.
I often myself wear two masks.
Fauci notes there's no official recommendation on what's better since there's no data yet to prove it. CDC Chief Rochelle Walensky says the agency's actively looking.
More data will be forthcoming from the CDC with regard to the value of double masking.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
A report by the UN Human Rights Office accuses North Korea of systematic widespread human rights violations to maintain control over the population, which the UN officials say may amount to crimes against humanity. Lisa Schlein is up next.
Hundreds of people who escaped from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea were interviewed for this report. UN monitors say the information gathered from their testimony provides reasonable grounds to believe crimes against humanity are being committed in the country's prison system. UN human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani tells VOA crimes against humanity continue in the ordinary prison system. She says there are credible accounts of systematic infliction of torture or other forms of severe physical and mental pain suffered by detainees.
We have found that 7 years on from a UN investigation which found that horrible crimes against humanity were being committed in the DPRK, including murder, enslavement, torture, and forced disappearances. We have found that 7 years later, not much has changed. Possible crimes against humanity are continuing and ongoing, and there has been no accountability for the past crimes that were documented.
The 15-page report documents in excruciating detail other forms of punishment meted out to prisoners, including extermination, rape, and other forms of sexual violence, denial of medical care, and starvation. It says political prisoners are subjected to the worst forms of cruelty. The report is calling on the international community to prioritize the human rights of the people in North Korea and to hold the government of Kim Jong-un accountable for grave violations. Shamdasani says political negotiations with North Korea are focused on nuclear non-proliferation issues. She says human rights issues are of secondary consideration.
There's been very little discussion of the human rights situation on the ground, very little discussion of justice and accountability for crimes against humanity. And what we are arguing is that if we are looking for lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula, this can only be achieved if such violations end and if the rights of the victims to justice, truth, reparations are fulfilled.
The report calls for an end to impunity in North Korea. It says proper investigation and prosecution of the alleged international crimes committed in the DPRK must be a priority. It urges the grave situation in the country be referred to the International Criminal Court or another comparable tribunal. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Korea plans to redefine what it means to be a family. The proposal will include various kinds of non-traditional unions, but same-sex partners are excluded. Jason Strother reports.
Kim Ju-won and her partner Park Sun-min have lived together with their six rescue cats for 5 years. But the two women don't tell everyone they're a couple because of prejudice towards South Korea's LGBTQ community. Kim, who's 30, says there's also legal discrimination. Same-sex marriage is banned in South Korea. She says she started thinking about her future, like getting married and having kids. But those aspirations are limited because they don't have equal rights. The government plans to expand the legal definition of family to include single parents as well as unmarried couples living together. But an official with the Ministry of Gender Equality and Family tells VOA News that this will not include same-sex partners. 36-year-old Park says that's unfair because it excludes them from many of the legal and financial benefits offered to straight couples. She says we consider each other life partners and want to live together and be treated the same as straight couples. Grace Chung, a professor at Seoul National University's Department of Family Studies, says in the government's eyes, same-sex families don't exist.
They do exist. Even though they're in the shadow, they still, you know, same-sex couples raise children together, but they can't get legal protection. They're not recognized.
Chung adds there's no law to protect the LGBTQ community from discrimination in South Korea. Seoul is broadening the legal definition of family in hopes of averting a demographic crisis. Last year, the country's population decreased for the first time, and the number of marriages and births are on a downward trend, according to official data. Surveys indicate that the cost of raising a child discourages many couples from starting families. Revising the legal definition of family would make more people eligible for economic incentives. Next year, the government will give cash bonuses to expecting couples and increase child care stipends. But Chung says incentives aren't working.
Statistics clearly show that birth rate isn't increasing, even with all the government policies that encourage, you know, married couples to have kids or to have more kids. But no good solutions yet.
Chung adds that by denying legal rights to same-sex couples, the government is blocking the creation of more families. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
Police have leveled their first formal charge against Myanmar's ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Members of her party say that she has been charged with possessing illegally imported walkie-talkies. The move gives military leaders who stage a coup a legal reason to hold her, at least through the middle of the month. United Nations spokesman Stephane Dujarric spoke to reporters about the development on Wednesday.
We continue and will continue to call for her immediate release, for the president's immediate release, and all others who have been detained by the military in the last few days. I think the charges filed against her just compound the undermining of the rule of law in Myanmar and the democratic process.
We're very concerned about their well-being, given the concern about well-being of anyone who is in detention. But on top of that, we're in a pandemic, as we all know. So that adds another level of concern. I'm not aware that we've been able to reach her or anyone else directly, nor that we've been able to speak to the highest level of the military. But we, our special envoy, will continue to speak, to establish contact with whoever she needs to speak to.
Suu Kyi has been under house arrest since Monday when top generals announced that they would take power for 1 year, accusing her government of not investigating the military's accusations of voter fraud in recent elections. Suu Kyi's party swept in that vote, and the military-backed party did poorly. A National League for Democracy spokesman said that the charge carries a maximum sentence of 3 years in prison. Staff members at 70 hospitals and medical departments in 30 towns across Myanmar stopped work on Wednesday to protest against the coup that ousted their leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Reuters' Libby Hogan takes it from here.
The sound of pots and pans rang out in protest in Myanmar's biggest city Tuesday night. Clangs and honking car horns marked the first widespread protest against the military's coup this week. Some shouted, "Evil be gone," a traditional gesture to drive out evil or bad karma. The military has refused to accept the election victory of the government of Aung San Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy Party, which won by a landslide last November. The army has imposed a state of emergency for a year after they swiftly seized power Monday, detaining Suu Kyi and others, claiming election fraud. Late Tuesday, a senior party official said he learned that Suu Kyi was under house arrest in the capital, Naypyidaw, and was, quote, in good health, but would not be moved. An earlier post said she was at her home, but Reuters was unable to confirm. And on Wednesday, 70 hospitals and medical departments across Myanmar stopped work to protest against the coup, according to a statement posted on Facebook.
Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Canadian government has designated the Proud Boys group as a terrorist entity. The government notes the Proud Boys played a pivotal role in the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and a senior official says that contributed to the designation. The Proud Boys is a far-right male chauvinist extremist group known for engaging in violent clashes at political rallies. The group has faced increased scrutiny after seizing on the former Trump administration's policies and was a major agitator during earlier protests and the Capitol riot on January 6th. Slain U.S. Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick laid in honor Wednesday in the building that he died defending. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
Blessed are the peacekeepers.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke at a congressional tribute to slain Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick.
We will never forget his sacrifice.
He lay in honor at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. President Biden and the First Lady had paid their respects on Tuesday night. Vice President Kamala Harris and her husband visited on Wednesday morning, placing their hands over their hearts and touching the urn with Sicknick's remains. There are still questions about Sicknick's death. He was one of five people who died as a result of the rioting at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Officers lined up outside the Capitol in respectful silence. Sicknick will be interred at Arlington National Cemetery. Jennifer King, Washington.
The United Nations Human Rights Office Wednesday said that it was deeply dismayed by the jailing of Russian critic Alexei Navalny.
In an embezzlement case that the European Court of Human Rights had already unanimously found to be arbitrary, unfair, and manifestly unreasonable.
Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani also called for the immediate release of those detained for their part in mass rallies in support of Navalny. The guinea worm, a waterborne parasite that 35 years ago infected an estimated 3.5 million people in nearly two dozen countries, mostly in Africa, has been nearly eradicated. This is thanks to cheap water filtration products, national planning, and grassroots education efforts, hardcore science, and the work of NGOs like the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Indeed, last year, only 27 people in six countries experienced the excruciating effects of the guinea worm, which takes a year to incubate in the human body after a person has ingested its larvae in drinking water. For the second part of our two-part series on the guinea worm and how it works and what's being done to put it forever in the past, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Adam Weiss, the director of the Carter Center's Guinea Worm Eradication Program. He began by outlining a few simple time-tested ways to avoid infection.
There's a number of very low cost, low tech solutions to help assist with stopping transmission. For example, both the straw filter or pipe filter and cloth filters that households and individuals can use to protect themselves from guinea worm that might be in the water that they're drinking, as well as having constant access to information from the volunteers about what's going on in their community or in neighboring communities so that they can take the necessary measures.
What is the basic life cycle of the guinea worm?
Somebody has guinea worm and they enter into a stagnant water body. The worm releases tens of thousands of larvae, and then there's a small little organism called a copepod that picks up the larva, and then after a few weeks, that larva is now infected, and if you drink that water, 1 year later, you will have guinea worm.
With a one-year lag time like that, it can be far from intuitive to somebody just how they got infected.
And so I have heard from people that it's juju or magic, it was a curse put on my family, that's why every year we have guinea worm. The science tells us differently. But how do you approach that person or that family if you can have discussions with them about even applying their own religious beliefs? For example, in many Muslim areas, the quality of your water is important in terms of performing certain religious activities. And so really helping them see it through their own systems and structures becomes very powerful, even if they've never had guinea worm themselves.
This idea of listening and taking the cue from the community itself is part and parcel of the Carter Center's holistic approach, which is still fairly unconventional.
I think that's the key. Guinea worm eradication program is not as simple as just a top-down approach where you have presidents, decrees, or policies that are going to help stop guinea worm transmission. You have to have a bottom-up approach that is owned and operated by the communities and the individuals of those communities. Then you also need all the other stakeholders that are part of supply chain processes, funding, helping with science, and refining our own ability to target interventions, understand Mother Nature and ecology and the different dynamics that go into transmission.
The Carter Center's guinea worm eradication program has been around since 1986 and has achieved almost total success. How do you still get people to make guinea worm eradication a real priority? Isn't it kind of out of sight, out of mind?
A lot of people know about guinea worm from firsthand experience in West Africa, particularly in Nigeria and in Ghana. Nigeria, when they first were starting to target guinea worm, there were more than 500,000 cases a year there. In Ghana, several hundred thousand cases a year. And having reduced infections from 3.5 million down to only 27 humans left in the world, the program, to a certain extent, becomes a victim of its own success. Younger generations didn't have that firsthand experience, but certainly there's been a lot of communication and dissemination of information about guinea worm through different awareness creation campaigns and cash reward systems to try and motivate people to come forward. So you kind of have the two pieces of it where you don't have a lot of people suffering with it right now, and so you don't have that kind of strong, this is impacting millions of people's lives today. But there still is an appreciation that this is a disease nobody wanted 30 years ago and nobody wants today. And I think in part what has made the guinea worm program so successful is that it's not about saying, here are the three interventions, just do this and everything will be fine, but helping people understand those interventions, helping them understand the transmission cycle, even if they didn't go to school, even if they don't know the scientific methods, that they can learn to appreciate what water looks like when I don't filter it, and what does it look like if I do filter it, and then what impacts me down the road from there.
You sound quite hopeful.
The end is well within reach, and we're going to continue to help cross the finish line.
That was the director of the Carter Center's Guinea Worm Eradication Program, Adam Weiss, speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. General Motors announced on January 28th that by 2035, it will produce all electric vehicles, except for heavy-duty trucks. It's the most far-reaching goal of any major automaker, and as Michael Sullivan reports, analysts say the move is part of a global trend.
It's an ambitious target. Manufacturing only electric cars, small trucks, and sports utility vehicles just 14 years from now, and becoming a carbon-neutral company 5 years later. General Motors CEO Mary Barra.
Our vision for the future is a world with zero crashes, zero emissions, and zero congestion.
Reducing reliance on fossil fuel and cutting the carbon dioxide emissions that are warming the planet. General Motors was an early entrant to the green market in December 2010 with its Chevy Volt electric gasoline hybrid. But in 2019, GM sided with the Trump administration to fight strict fuel emission standards enacted by California and followed by 12 other states. Under new GM management and a new U.S. administration, the trajectory is shifting, says a business professor who was a former chief economist and group vice president at Ford, Martin Zimmerman.
So I think what's happening here is a realignment of General Motors, and certainly it's getting its policy or its vision is aligned with where the Biden administration is going.
And where the industry has been moving, though slowly. The startup Tesla has proven that electric vehicles can appeal to consumers, but the U.S. market remains small, note analysts. Tyson Jomini is vice president for data and analytics at the market research firm J.D. Power.
Our EV market is only about 2% right now, and the rest of the world, Europe this past quarter hit 10%.
China's EV market is more than 5%. Norway, the world leader, electric vehicles have a market share of more than 50%. But Americans love big gas-guzzling SUVs and trucks, high-profit vehicles for manufacturers, says Bruce Belzowski of the Automotive Futures Group.
Last year, 70% of all sales in the U.S. were SUVs or pickup trucks. So if you're talking about selling electric vehicles, you're going to have to be in those segments.
But it's challenging. When designed as electric vehicles, trucks and SUVs will have slimmer profit margins. Still, GM will release a large Hummer EV pickup later this year and expand its offerings by the end of the decade. Also, batteries for electric vehicles are expensive, says Tyson Jomini.
But there is an expectation that, the battery cost is coming down pretty rapidly. And then beyond that, as we keep seeing with Tesla announcements, range keeps getting further and further.
Now, recharging stations are limited, especially for long trips. A recent J.D. Power survey shows that worries EV owners, former Ford executive Zimmerman.
And likely you need government help to get over this chicken and egg problem. And by that I mean is consumers won't buy the vehicles unless there are fuel stations out there. But people aren't going to want to invest in fuel stations unless there are vehicles that will get charged there.
Government incentives, increased consumer demand, improved technology, expanded infrastructure, and price drops. There remain many parts to the puzzle before electric vehicles can dominate the market. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Behind GameStop's U.S. stock surge is the grim reality of its prospects. The video game retailer is floundering, even as the industry around it is booming. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
GameStop was swept up in a battle between big-moneyed hedge funds betting against it and small investors trying to prop it up, causing shares to soar 1,600% despite shaky financials underneath. Shares have since cratered. The company's quarterly report shows a sales decline as it struggles to adapt to mobile gaming and digital downloads that render stores obsolete. GameStop's new board member, Ryan Cohen, the founder of online pet store Chewy, has raised hopes of a turnaround, even though experts say he faces challenges he wants to focus online. I'm Julie Walker.
In the realm of film, the year 2021 seems to be the year of women. Dozens of acclaimed films and TV series by female directors pondering a woman's complex world are being released every week. Many are already Oscar contenders, and VOA's Penelope Pulu takes a look at a few examples.
Promising Young Woman, a dark comedy by director Emerald Fennell, follows 30-year-old Cassie, a once promising medical student, on a mission.
Every week, I go to a club. I act like I'm too drunk to stand. And every week, a nice guy comes over to see if I'm okay.
You okay? You are so pretty.
Pretending she's drunk and helpless, Cassie lures sexual predators and punishes them. It's payback for the death of her best friend, a victim of sexual assault who killed herself in college 10 years ago.
10 years later, and she's still living
very much in the center of the trauma of what happened to her, but she's trying to find a way through it. And her way through it is to sort of one by one correct injustices.
Carey Mulligan says the film exudes a subtle horror.
It is not the extremes and the absolute worst violence that is experienced by women, or the worst violations. It's the really subtle stuff that we've just become so used to in our society.
The film is receiving buzz for Oscar nominations.
Sophie Marciano.
Losing Alice by Israeli-American director Sigal Avin is a dark Israeli TV series on the power dynamic between two women. Alice, played by Israeli actress Ayelet Zurer, is a 40-something filmmaker juggling life as an artist, a mother, and a wife. Sophie, a young, intense scriptwriter and actress, is brimming with creativity and unbridled ambition. The two women meet on a train and start a partnership. Alice will direct Sophie's script, an erotic psychological thriller, with Alice's famous husband as the lead actor. Actress Ayala Zurer says the sexual triangle runs more like an existential story about the price female artists are willing to pay for creativity and success, about the power play between older and younger women, and about women's unapologetic goal to have it all.
A woman has to do something awful to save her kids, or something questionable to save her kids or her marriage or something. It has to have a reason, otherwise we can't forgive her. But in this case, what Sigal has done is that she does it for herself, just because she wants to.
The series is streaming in over 100 countries.
Wow.
Oscar-winning actress and Grammy-winning singer Jennifer Hudson brings Aretha Franklin on the large screen in Lizzo Tommy's biopic called Respect. The film follows the rise of the Queen of Soul from her childhood as a choir singer to her international superstardom. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a tremendous Thursday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is staying in the World Health Organization. Shortly after taking the oath of office, President Joe Biden signed a letter retracting former President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the World Health Organization, or WHO. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke by phone with World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus to discuss a decision by the United States to reverse its withdrawal from the WHO, fulfill its financial obligations, and work as a constructive partner to strengthen and reform the WHO. Vice President Harris emphasized that she and President Biden believe the WHO is vital to controlling COVID-19 and building up better global health and pandemic preparedness. Dr. Anthony Fauci was named the new head of the United States delegation to the 148th Executive Board meeting of the WHO. During remarks at the WHO Executive Board meeting, Dr. Fauci said, "I join my fellow representatives in thanking the World Health Organization for its role in leading the global public health response to this pandemic. The Biden administration also intends to be fully engaged in advancing global health, supporting global health security and the global health security agenda, and building a healthier future for all people, he said. Dr. Fauci announced the Biden administration's plans to join COVAX and support the ACT Accelerator to advance multilateral efforts for COVID-19 vaccine, therapeutic, and diagnostic distribution and development around the world. COVAX's aim is to accelerate the development and manufacture of COVID-19 vaccines and to guarantee fair and equitable access for every country in the world. This is a good day for WHO and a good day for global health, WHO Director General Ghebreyesus said. In a tweet, he added, WHO is a family of nations, and we are all glad that the United States is staying in the family.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.